And thank you for the letter you wrote to my son. And this is a very touch for it.
And here, four people showed up, but we didn't know how to reach.
This is, thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much. I didn't obviously read the whole thing, but I...
No, Mr. So C, it's a Talmud.
It was great.
There'll be a few, Gabby, there'll be a few more people wandering in, so we won't be as parse as the parsity you see now, but Be'ezrat Hashem Yetov. Okay, just gotta watch. We can begin in 1 second. Where are we up to? Here we are. Okay. Today is Monday morning, March 6th, 2017. And today is a very, very sad moment for those of you who have a Torah soul. 100 years ago, a school on 122nd Street in Broadway that was begun as an Orthodox institution in response to the Reform gradually started to tamper with the Dvar Hashem su halacha, what has kept us Jews since Maimon HaSinai, overwhelmed by the Western world, the American experience, and they started to make innovations. It is now exactly 100 years later, and if you followed the news this morning, the United Synagogue voted practically unanimously, 94-8, with one abstention, to allow non-Jews to become members of conservative temples. And it's beyond comprehension. And you understand why, because there's so many intermarried couples. So the man or the woman wants to belong, but she doesn't want to belong without her husband or wife. And beyond words, what happens when you start to tamper with the Dvar Hashem? Minimally. Well, all right, they took the mechitza down, Spoke about this in length years ago with all the halachic implications. But coming back to the topic at hand, Rav Yitzchak Kutner today is a fascinating shia. First of all, we're now going through his life the third time, but now I'm going through with sources, unique sources. I want to mention that Chabad, maybe because of our lectures right here in class, that we've spoken about the Rav Kutner's ambivalent attitude towards Chabad. Chabad came out with a whole revelation of letters between Rav Kutner and the Rebbe. So there's no question that there was a relationship. I would best sum it up that to a certain degree, Rav Kutner had a part of his heart was Hasidic. There's no two ways about it. You see that from the Maral, you see the way he conducted himself. He evidently had some hesitancy because of the messianic spirit that overwhelmed Chabad to a certain degree. And this will explain why he got upset when La'alta L'tshuva, La'alta L'gu'ula, what we spoke about with the sixth Rebbe. But he did have a relationship with the seventh and a very strong relationship. They learned together. And throughout the decades, there was correspondence between them. So that's an interesting chapter that has to be explored further if a proper doctorate will be done on Rav Yitzchak Kutner. Then last week we picked up again and we spoke about Eretz Yisrael, his love for Eretz Yisrael. We quoted from his letters, his writings, and for his entire life, Rav Kutner suffered within the fact that he had left Eretz Yisrael, wound up in America, wound up in the United States, but with all that he achieved in America, the lack of Israel bothered him. And as you all know, he was kidnapped to Jordan, and after that kidnapping, for the next 10 years of his life, the final 10 years of his life, part in America, part in Eretz Yisrael, the dream of building in Eretz Yisrael, the realities of the politics in Eretz Yisrael, it was not a totally happy decade. And what we spoke about last time with Pachad Yitzchak, I still can't answer the question. I'll state the question in a minute. But if you recall, we spoke about that he wanted to open up a center in what he considered the heart of Jerusalem, which was North Jerusalem, which then already was well populated, and his big balabas, Fruchthandler, the Abi Fruchthandler, they bought the property, prime property in North Jerusalem, and they were swallowed up with bells. And he winds up in Harnof, and he died while all this was happening, Rav Huttner, and the Harnof branch remains a kollel, but it's not a real influence on the Israeli scene. If you don't know what kollel Pachad Yitzchak is, you're not going to read about it in the newspapers. It's a small institution, all right? It's an institution, it's a kollel that's learning, Rav Hillel David. His daughter Bruria is a big success story with the Beis Shak of Yerushalayim. We'll come back to Bruria, but not today. And the question that I don't have an answer, no one responds, no one talks about it, is you see online all the enmity from the Chaim Berlin people towards the Belz Rebbe. So I can understand the enmity on the level that the Belz, the enclave of Belz, somehow bought out, surrounded Rav Huttner. And again, when let's talk, we live in a democracy. Democracies have one tremendous problem. Everyone has a vote. Politicians manipulate. So there's no question that Belz had more influence on the city council than Rav Huttner. For the sake of argument, Belz controls 20,000, 30,000 votes in Yerushalayim. Rav Huttner controlled 10 votes, 20 votes, 30 votes, not more. So I can understand their mad at Belz, and the language, again, on the internet, the language you see is very frightening, because there's no control. Everyone, the more they curse, the smarter they think they are, I'll put it that way. So there's tremendous hatred towards Belz. But the other problem, and this I have no answer, they claim it's not only that Belz stopped Rav Huttner from building in the north, but in addition, Avram Fruchthandler lost a fortune of money. And this I don't understand, because to my mind, if you buy property and Belz wants to buy you out, they have to pay you. What does it mean? He lost money, lost a fortune of money, and they call the Belz Chassidim Kulam Ganavim. That's what the statement they attribute to the successors of Rav Huttner, to his son-in-law. I don't have an answer. No one, I asked last time, if you recall, if anyone is listening, can you please explain to me why Fruchthandler lost all that money? If, fine, Belz wanted the property, they bought him out, but buying him out, you can be angry you lost the property, but at least your money you get back. That, and to that I do not have an answer. Okay. Let me go further, and here's the amazing thing. If you recall, 5-6 minutes ago, I began the shiur by telling you what happened with the conservative movement as of yesterday. What we can't comprehend today is that JTS began as an Orthodox institution, and for many decades it had Orthodox people, frontline Orthodox people, teaching there. For many decades, many of the students of JTS were totally religious. Even in the students of the 30s, the 40s, into the 50s, so many of them became rabbis in conservative temples, but in their own personal life, they remained totally frum. And you don't have a better example than Rabbi Morris Friedman, whose son has become so prominent, David Friedman. President Trump wants to nominate him as ambassador to Israel, and you see the hatred, the enmity of the reform, of the conservative against him, to testify in Congress that he's too frum, he's too Jewish. I mean, indeed, it's overwhelming, but just think what's happening. So Rabbi Morris Friedman was rabbi of a conservative temple, but in his all his kids are 100% frum, and in his personal life, he and his wife were 100% frum, and this was a phenomenon. Now, why am I telling you this? Because, Yitzchak, you already missed the news. The news, what has happened. Okay, you'll make it up over the internet. Why am I telling you all this? Because when Rav Yitzchak Kuttner came to America, the man needs panasa, a place to hang his hat. In his case, he didn't need panasa. You know that he married a lady who had a PhD, Papa has dough, he was well taken care of, his own family was well off, and he never had the agot ha-panasa. But he needs a place to hang his hat. Even if you come to Israel with money, you need, you know, with someone who's a Talmud Chacham, and he doesn't need a salary in Israel. He needs a place. He needs a place to teach. And you all understand that. He needs a place. You need a place to hang your hat. Do you know that he turned to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and asked Rav Moshe to help him get an appointment with Professor Louis Ginsberg at the Jewish Theological Seminary? And you see, this is very revealing. And I'll show you. How do I know? I'll show you in a second. It cannot be denied. But very revealing. See, Art Scroll would have a lot of difficulty in doing an honest biography of Reb Aaron Kuttner and Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, because I've spoken more than once about Reb Aaron. I'm not the only one who says it. We lack the most. Reb Aaron Kuttner, when you look at it in America, three gedolim had unbelievable influence. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Aaron Kuttner, and Moriah Rebbe, Reb Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. I don't want to get into an argument who is more important. Each one will say my Rebbe. There's no question that the Lubavitcher Rebbe's influence is unbelievably greater than both the Rav and Reb Aaron Kuttner put together. But nevertheless, in the Litvish world, the rebirth of the learning of Torah, of the anti-secularism, the anti-Western world, Reb Aaron's influence in America, good at Israel, was overwhelming. The Rav, the whole YU world, the whole so-called Western Orthodox world, modern Orthodox world, the Rav single-handedly created this world, and that world remained from those loyal to the Rav. Vitova Lichtenstein says, you would have never had a modern Orthodox world synagogue. Everyone would have moved right. The Rav gave people a chance to successfully manipulate both worlds in harmonious coexistence, Torah and the Western world. Their influence was unbelievable. So here, Rav Kuttner comes to America, and who will he turn to? Art Scroll would have a tremendous problem dealing with this episode, but you have to understand it. As we'll see in a few minutes, Rav Kuttner was very close to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. At a certain point in life, he was closer to Rav Moshe than anyone else in the world. Fine, and that was yet in Europe. So now he comes to America, and here he has someone to turn to. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is already in America in 1929. Rav Kuttner came, you'll see, I told you, it's a Machlokes HaPoskim 34 or 35. Everyone has a different year. I believe he probably sailed in 34 and arrived in 35. So he comes to America, he turns to Rav Moshe. Now, Rav Kuttner by this point had been in Berlin. He had broadened. He not only wrote Chidushei Torah, Torah Tanazir, published, he also was working on a scholarly edition of the Sifra with early commentaries. So who do you turn to? And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rav Kuttner turn to Louis Ginsberg. Now, Levi Ginsberg, as I spoke about years ago, very interesting individual. He was a Gon Adir from the yeshiva world. Everyone knew the name Louis Ginsberg. No one questioned his mind, his knowledge. He was a great-great nephew of the Vilna Gaon. He called the Vilna Gaon in his writings, he calls him his uncle, his elder uncle. Dodi Hazakein, he had tremendous, and in his youth, he had a photographic memory. I mean, the man's knowledge was overwhelming. Not only that, his frumkeit in his youth, and you know the famous story, he was a follower of the Musa movement, and his mother came to visit him, hadn't seen him in months, and he refused to talk to his own mother during Chodesh Elul, because he was on a 40-day Ta'anit Dibur. Gabi, you don't know that. I saw that with my own eyes. Chodesh Elul, this is in what Chodesh Elul was. Even the fish in the water were shaking with fear. In Lakewood, I yet saw people who from Rosh Chodesh Elul on to Matzoh Yom Kippur did not speak outside of davening and learning. If you were sitting at the table with them and they wanted salt, they would have to bang and point to the salt. And could you imagine his mother came to see him, Kibar Aviyain Bimata Neda, and he refused to speak to his mother. It was Chodesh Elul, and he was in a tiny dibur for 40 days. Okay, you know what the concept is, because many of our sins, Lashon Hara, Rechilut, we get angry, Baal Gaiva, we curse, whatever. If you learn how to control your mouth, not to speak when you don't have to, you control your speech.
I'm
not
with my mother-in-law all year.
Your mother-in-law, kind of with your mother-in-law, that says just the opposite. You should be machabed, your mother-in-law, out of love for your wife, plain and simple. Okay, but all right, we'll leave that for Seth, your father, to straighten out. So what happened with Louis Ginsberg? Later he broadens, and there's no question he gets involved with biblical criticism. Some of you are familiar with his publications on the Yerushalmi. A gone idea, and then he got involved with the Bible and legends of the Bible. And there certainly was, to a certain degree, certainly in his younger years in America, he was carried away with biblical criticism. Later in life, he regretted it. This is what I'm told. He remained the Shomer Mitzvah as he understood it. He was a big Lamdan, he could paskin. There are various stories about him where with the Shabbos elevator. Again, you never know what the anecdotes are, but they do reveal when someone asked him if they can use the elevator on Shabbos in the Upper West Side where he lived, he said, no, probably what it meant is the going into an elevator where there was an elevator man, and you had to tell him what floor, whatever. He told this person a chumran. The same person sees Louis Ginsberg going into the elevator on Shabbos. So the anecdote goes, the person says, Professor Ginsberg, you told me you can't use it, and you're using it. So he answered, you asked, I didn't. That's the anecdote. But you get a feeling who Louis Ginsberg was, a gone shebegoyim. No, how do we know that they approached Louis Ginsberg? I have a Talmud that you all know, a very famous Talmud, Rabbi Dr. Professor Mark Shapiro. I can show you the room which I taught him in. It's on the other side of this floor. I can show you exactly where he sat. It's about 80, 81. And in my class was the first time he ever heard about Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. He later does the brilliant doctorate. It was the last doctorate done under Dr. Tversky at Harvard University. And if you don't believe me, read his introduction. He thanks me. I have a girl. I mean, she's a grandmother 100 times over today, but she's still a girl. I taught her in 71 in Mechala, Israeli girl. Oh, what knowledge that girl had leaving. So the first time she ever heard about Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg was in my class in Mechala. And who did she marry? Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg's Talmud Mufaka, Rabbi Avram Abba Weingut from Switzerland. That was the home that Rabbi Chiel Yaakov lived in after World War II. And whenever I meet them, they always remind me she first heard about the Yonah Levi. Her father was a Yekka, was a Talmud Chacham. Her grandfather was a famous Yekka doctor, a medical doctor. And her father taught her all of Shas, Shisha, Sidra, Mishnah. This girl knew, a Harev graduate. You see, Harev graduates aren't bad. The new Supreme Court justice was 2 years ahead of my eldest daughter in Harev. But I taught with her mother and father. She's an Arieli. Her mother and father taught with me in various, in Machon Gold, in BMT, over the years. What a family. Anyway, Mark Shapiro is professor at a Jesuit university. He holds the Weinberg chair, nothing to do with Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, but it's a Jew named Weinberg who gave heavy money to this university in Scranton. I think it's called Scranton University, and he holds that chair. And it's funded. There's a lot of money.
So he's very blessed. He teaches a few courses a week. It's not that he has to teach a new course every year. It's not that he's teaching Gedolei Yisrael as we are teaching Gedolei Yisrael at this moment, because there are listening via the website. So he has time for research, whatever he finds he can publish. So I'm now quoting to you from Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. Volume by Mark B. Shapiro, University of Scranton Press. And if you go to page 4, he publishes a letter from 1935. Lichvod HaRav HaGon HaGadol. Could you imagine Reb Moshe Soloveitchik addressing Professor Louis Ginsberg? Charlie, check with your brother if he believes this is possible, okay? Bounce it off him. L'chvod ha-rav ha-gon ha-gadol v'chulu ma'alatu kvodo Reb Levi Ginsberg near your ear. Acharei drishat ha-shalom. I'll say it in English, but this is rabbinic Hebrew.
What year is that?
1935. When he just arrived in America, you can see it's a little after he arrived in America. He's looking around. Where am I going to hang my hat? May I introduce to your most honorable Gaon, my dear friend, the young Gaon who is excellent, Rav Yitzchak Hutman Neirel Yair Mevasha. Yodea, I know him very well. I know him from my days in Warsaw. I know him to have a tremendous mind, tremendous ability. He is one of a kind among the young generation. Talmud Chacham, v'gon mufhak, b'yediyat v'avanat ha-Torah, b'vlo muvan ha-milah. He is innovative, machadesh, kiddushay Torah, in all the areas of Torah, in a fine, upright fashion. And he understands the Torah so well and so clear. The world already knows about him because of his Sefer Torah HaNazir, Masechet Nazir. And I heard from him, he would like to speak, Lamad Kvod Gedulato, would like to visit you. And therefore I'm writing this letter so you should know who he is and receive him with the honor that is due to him. Birchat kol tov l'malat kvod gonato mokiro u'machabdo Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik. Okay, so here you see the young Rav Hutner in America looking for a place to hang his hat. He has just arrived. Who are they? What are they? What is this relationship? Who is Rav Hutner? We don't have a better document than what I'm going to introduce to you in one moment. Give me a second. My nose is still not perfect, but Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll get there. Yeah. Gentlemen, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Soloveitchik family, a most interesting family. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was the eldest son of Rav Chaim Brisker. You mentioned the name Rav Chaim Brisker. Even Natan has to shake a little. Even he has affinity to Rav Nachman, etc. Rav Chaim Brisker. Even Alex has to shake. Why? The Rebbe's father got smicha from Rav Chaim Brisker. Be aware of it. Okay. Reb Yitzchak Levi, the Rebbe's father. Reb Moshe was the eldest son, and Reb Moshe did not have an easy life. He ate kest by his father-in-law, Reb Elia Feinstein. As he approached the end of the 10 years kest, the time came to go out. You know what kest means? I'm throwing out a word. Do you know what kest means, Jonathan? Kest, you stop me, ask me. It's a Yiddish word, but it's used in English today. Even the New York Times would use it. It may even be in the unabridged Webster. Kest means that your in-laws agree to support you for a number of years, so you should sit and learn. It's before there were koilelim. So at Gegessen Kest of his father-in-law, Rebellia Feinstein, that's Rebellia Prushana. And then he went into the rabbinate. Reizun was the first rabbinate he went into. He had a lot of Akmas Nefesh there. It was not easy. From there, he went to Chaslavich. Chaslavich becomes very famous because the Rav becomes who he is, partially as a result of Chaslavich. That's the whole Hasidic, Agadic, philosophic, homiletical, emotional addition to the Rav that he did not get from the brisker side of the family. But Chaslavich falls to the communists, and the Soloveitchik family has to run away, smuggled out of the country. You can read Reb Moshe's daughter Shulamit Soloveitchik Meiselman's memoir, The Soloveitchik Heritage, how they're smuggled out, fear, death, what goes on. Very sad. Overnight, Chaslavich, which was 90% Shomer Shabbos, becomes 90% Mechallel Shabbos with the communists. It's frightening what happened 100 years ago. So the family winds up in Warsaw. In Warsaw, Reb Moshe, what does he do? Where can he teach? Where does he fit in? So he winds up in the Mizrahi Tachmoni Seminary, head of the Talmudic department. Even there, if I may say it in Yiddish, et nishgelek kein honig. Translation, it's in Yiddish, he didn't lick honey. You get the message.
Wasn't
a bowl of cherries, I guess, in English. But the Nishkelek kein honig in Warsaw. He had a big fight. There was Professor Balaban, Reb Meir Balaban, was more into Chochmat Yisrael, and Reb Meisher argued with him, many arguments about Torah Shebal Peh and how you understand it. And Meir Balaban was the Balabas, and he owned the institution, as if to speak, and Reb Meisher suffered. So Reb Meisher was anxious to leave. And you all know what happened in America. We spoke about it a few weeks ago. The Meitzer Ta'ili died, and Rabbi Revel, what happened was Reb Lazy Yehuda Finkel was visiting America. I didn't say this when I went into, I couldn't go into all the detail. So Reb Lazy Yehuda, of course, knew Rabbi Revel, knew the Mechita. He actually had been a Chavruta with the Mechita in their youth. And he said to Rabbi Revel, look, I know you're looking for a successor. I know of an Adam Gadol who will be willing to leave Eastern Europe. He's not happy there right now. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. So believe it or not, I found a draft of the original letter that my cousin Rabbi Revel wrote to Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, inviting him to become Rosh Yeshiva. I found it in Rabbi Revel's archives, his personal files, in the two suitcases that Mrs. Revel was ready to throw out. And Reb Moshe accepted. And his wife was overjoyed because Reb Moshe was much more conservative with a small c than Rebbetzin Pesher. Rebbetzin Pesher was already open to the big world, as you all know. A lot has been written about this. It's not a secret. I mean, I know it from being close to the family, but today you can find it in the Shulamit Meiselman's book, and more people have published on it. So she was overjoyed. So Reb Moshe now applies for a visa, and he hits the anti-Semitism throughout the world. The consul in Warsaw wouldn't give him a visa because he had had an ingrown toenail operation. And he took a law that after you have an operation, you have to wait 6 months to apply again. So that's how Reb Shimon Shkop, who was visiting America to raise money for Telz, for Grodno, I should say, for his yeshiva in Grodno. He had left Telz, he was in Grodno. It was the Shari Tori yeshiva. Reb Shimon left his son and son-in-law in charge. Reb Feivel Hindus, his son-in-law, and his son, Reb Moshe Mordechai, and he was in America raising money. Rabbi Revel knew Reb Shimon Shkop because he had studied with him for one semester. The only time Rabbi Revel ever went to yeshiva, he was autodidactic. The only time he ever learned in a yeshiva was one semester in Telz. So he knew Reb Shimon is in America, so he turned to Reb Shimon, du soll bleiben da, remain here. He met with the Shimon's Talmud, a Dr. Gordon from Brooklyn. They worked out a contract for $10,000 a year, $3,000 for Shimon to live on, and $7,000 to go back to Telz, which was a tremendous sum of money at that time, in Telz, in Poland. Not Telz, whenever I say Telz, correct me, to Grodno. Reb Shimon is now in Grodno. So Reb Shimon was there for a year, and he had to go back, without getting into detail now. Chabad Chaim, Reb Chaim Moises, ordered him back because students, what makes a yeshiva yeshiva is the faculty. And if the faculty is not tops, the yeshiva will go under. You see what happened to Telz in America, in the suburb that they were in Cleveland. You got to have top quality. It's not a Hasidic court. A Hasidic court, if you are Belza, and the Tata's given a Belza, and the Zeta's given a Belza, so you're loyal to the Belza Rebbe no matter what. You're not going to go elsewhere. But if you don't like what's going on in Telz, you're going to go to Lakewood in America. You don't like what's going on in Mir, you're going to go here, you're going to go there. Why you? In my days, why you? And Torah Vadas and Chaim Berlin, students went back and forth. Today it's a little different, but it's still in the Litvish world. What I'm saying applies 100%. So Reb Shimon went back. They told him, if you don't come back, your yeshiva will fall apart. Your son and son-in-law are not the attraction you are. So Reb Shimon went back. So finally Reb Moshe gets the visa, and he arrives in America December 1929. He should have arrived September, October 1928. So a year and a number of months later, he finally arrives. Now, the family only joins in him a number of months later. When Reb Moshe leaves Europe, he is very upset because his youngest son, Reb Moshe had two sons, two daughters, and then the Mezhinik, Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. Now, Reb Moshe's eldest son was the apple of his eye. If you read Shulamit Meiselman's memoir, she's angry at her father because of the favoritism he showed the Reb Yosef Dov, and not his brother, who was at face 2 years younger than him, Reb Shmuel. And of course, I knew Reb Shmuel. I'm one of the few people in the world that can say I studied with all three Soloveitchik brothers. Reb Shmuel went on to become a brilliant professor of chemistry, and he told us, quoting Reb Shmuel, we were very close to him. I learned a lot of chemistry from him, which I never followed up on. My grandchildren involved with chemistry, but Dalman Amorit, I have granddaughters-in-law involved in chemistry, getting PhDs, Hebrew U. But outside of class, we used to bother Reb Shmuel. Did you have Reb Shmuel, Yitzchak? We used to bother him all the time about his family. So many things he told us, but I'll never forget, he said, you know the difference between me and my brother? You know, the Rav. He says, my brother and I would learn with our father. And my father would say, do you understand? And I would say, yes, even if I didn't. My brother would say, no, I don't understand. My father would smack him and go over it again with him. And that's how my brother became the Rav, and I became a professor of chemistry. That was Reb Shmuel. Wonderful, wonderful individual. Also, a very sad life. If I would write novels about what I've seen in life, I could buy Gruss 10 times over.
Was he still very involved in learning, even though he was a
Of course. He was constantly, he was a tzaddik, but he had no children. He suffered. At the end of his life, it was very sad. His wife was Isha Gedolah Gedolah. No one was married to anyone like his wife, Batsheva Ziv Chutner. Batsheva Ziv Soloveitchik, afterwards Chutna. She married Reb Yitzchak's first cousin, Reb Yoshua Bezivik Sheni, for both of them had lost their first spouses. She was in Isha Gedolah. Oh, wow. Until today, I stand in awe of she's related to Reb, to the Chevron Rosh, to the Panovich Rosh Yeshiva, the Rizalski family. Oh, what a lady. So, with his youngest son already, he didn't want to take chances By this time, the Rebbe's in Berlin, Rav Shmuel is in Belgium studying chemistry, has a PhD. He was very bright. He had patents in something with oil. He was a very bright individual, Rav Shmuel, and he didn't want to take chances with Rav Aaron. So he's leaving this little kid, 12 years old, who was the, you know, his mijinik, and he's learning with the kid, and he has to run to America, and he, you know, he hopes the family will catch up with him. So at this point, if you recall, I told you that Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, who went through many periods in his life, has now returned from Israel, has returned to Lithuania, and he comes to Warsaw. Now, you have to understand what Warsaw was. I alluded to it yesterday. Warsaw was the heart of Yiddishkeit in Eastern Europe by this time. Haskalah, innovation, communism, Bolshevikism, socialism, secular Zionism, the inroads that were made in Russia, White Russia, the Ukraine, it was no longer the center, no longer filled, even Vilna, which was called the Vilna, the Yerushalayim of Lithuania, there was Chilul Shabbos per Parhesia, even in Vilna. Warsaw became the hotbed of Hasidic activity, the center of Gura, Alexander, the biggest Hasidus, the center, the pulse of Agudat Yisrael, which was a very powerful organization by this point. So even though in Warsaw you had socialists and secularists and Zionists who were not frum, but you also had the heart of the Mizrahi movement, the heart of Aguda, the heart of the Hasidic world. And the Hasidic world before World War II, you have to understand, we're talking in terms of millions of Hasidim. Millions. Warsaw was tremendous percentage of Jews. Poland in general had at least 1 out of 10 Poles was Jewish, if not more. And tremendous Hasidic center, all the great Rebbeim, all the courts. Now, even Lubavitch, this is what I alluded to yesterday, that when the Rebbe who ran the Tomchei Tamimim Yeshiva, the sixth Rebbe, the biggest yeshiva ultimately is in Warsaw. And when the sixth Rebbe in 1928 marries off his daughter, his middle daughter, to the seventh Rebbe to be, he holds the wedding in Warsaw. His court was in Riga, but he felt that this wedding is very special. He's getting a son-in-law. Whenever you mention the seventh Rebbe to the sixth Rebbe, his eyes lit up, you understand. He was getting a very unique son-in-law. This was a young man who knew Kol HaTorah Kula, including Sifrei Kabbalah by heart, not just Shas, Paiskim, Rashi, Tosfot, by heart, the Rebbe's memory. Anyone who met the Rebbe stood in awe of his memory, including the Rav, for example. I can give you other names, big Bekiyim. They stood in Reb Pinchas Hirschsprung of Montreal. They stood in awe of the Rebbe. Oh, what a memory, what knowledge, what insight, what understanding. So everything turned to Warsaw. And here Reb Moshe is leaving, but Rav Yitzchak Kuttner had come to Warsaw to seek out the Hasidic world, to seek out Gedolei Yisrael who were there. And he sought out Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. And he became very close. Here was Reb Moshe in the prime of life. Here was Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, a youngster, in his 20s yet, a young man. Here he is in Warsaw, and they become very close. When Reb Moshe leaves, he puts Reb Yitzchak Kuttner in charge of Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. And that's how the relationship begins. And Reb Aaron's bar mitzvah which Rabaran described it. It was on a weekday. It was called to the Torah. You drank a schnapps, a lachayim, a kichel, whatever. It's not the bar mitzvahs we have today, but who guided him? He had no father then, Reb Yitzchak Kotner. So they become very close. This will explain to you later in life, when Rabaran graduates the yeshiva, when Rabaran gets smicha from his cousin, Reb Moshe Feinstein, when Rabaran is teaching in MTJ, but is looking for something bigger, better, broader, on a higher level, Reb Yitzchak Kotner brings him to Masifta Chaim Berlin. And when I was growing up, we all knew the Rosh Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin is Reb Yitzchak Kotner, but the second in command, who's entirely immersed in learning, is Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. Now, Reb Aaron was an interesting individual. He had, you see, when you speak about Reb Aaron the Rav, it's overwhelming. You're comparing apples and oranges. What do I mean by that? The Rav grew up with a golden spoon. He yet saw Reb Chaim. He yet learned with his father, Reb Moshe B'Menuchat HaNefesh, in the Feinstein home. You all know the famous chapter that everyone quotes and requotes, Karl Brenner, Yitzchak, Dershowitz is so upset. Do you have, for anyone here, see Friday's Jerusalem Post? They say there was an ad there that Professor Karl Brenner from Penasken's name right is giving a lecture on Soloveitchik, no title whatsoever. Giving a lecture on Soloveitchik and something, no title, just like David Hartman, Soloveitchik.
There's a lecture, do you know?
I didn't see the post, I can't.
There was no Rabbi Soloveitchik, no doctor.
No rabbi, no doctor, no professor, no nothing. Just Soloveitchik. It's his bosom buddy. Like I would say, I just spoke with Yitz Rubin today. He just, I don't get upset anymore. Maybe I'm ashamed of myself. I've seen this so many times already. What I had with David Hartman, I don't get upset. Sam Dershowitz, an Elicha guy, he was so upset this morning. We're walking to shul. He's practically in tears. But okay, this is the reality. So you see, the Rav had a golden spoon. Zayda, his father, his other grandfather, Rav Elia Pruzhana, Reb Aaron, he never saw Reb Chaim. He was born, Reb Chaim died. So what are we talking about? The end of World War One. He never saw, who did he ever see? Reb Moshe. But by the time he was 12, Reb Moshe's in America. He comes to America, so from the day he comes to America, he goes into his father's shiura at the yeshiva and yeshiva college, what today is called Yeshiva University. He studies, graduates Talmudical Academy, graduates Yeshiva College, and he's constantly studying with his father in a classroom situation, but it's not with the same Menuchat HaNefesh, Reb Moshe, America, the adjustment, the money problems, the depression. You don't know what these people went through. But Reb Aaron, self-made, unbelievable matmid, unbelievable knowledge of Shas and Rishonim. He was Kol HaTorah Kula in his two hands. And Reb Aaron, very special. Then he goes to law school. So if you knew Reb Aaron, he was an excitable individual. The way he spoke, you couldn't imagine he's going to go before a judge, represent someone, speak, try to make a case. You have to understand, being a lawyer in the United States, it's not like England where law is divided in two. In America, you're a lawyer, you have to represent someone, you have to go before the judge. You have to, part of it is fake a ride, you understand? It's like a rabbi preaching a sermon. You can have tremendous knowledge, but if you don't know how to speak, it's a waste of time. Then you can have rabbis who know next to nothing, but they take an RCA manual and they take a drasha, and with that beautiful English polish, they're speaking, conveying ideas, and you can sway the judge, you can sway the jury. You know how Reb Aaron made a living? He was a lawyer's lawyer. He prepared briefs for lawyers that had to appear in court, like Shelton Shuvin. If you ever saw the way a brief works, if you ever worked in the Supreme Court, you see how they prepare for the judges and how the lawyers come in and they cite this case and that case and the other case and the president. It's mamish lahavdil, like writing the tshuva lahalacha, where you're citing rishonim and achronim and Shelton Shuvin and precedents. Rav Aaron, it's on Gainish Shekab, part-time, he would prepare briefs. The lawyer would appear in court like a genius, sway the judge, sway the jury, prepared by a young man named Rav Aaron Soloveitchik.
Where did you go to law school?
I don't know offhand. Maybe it's in here. If not, we can check in Wikipedia. That's what Wikipedia is great about.
Was there any specific area of law that he specialized in?
Not that I know of, but maybe his son mentions it.
And it was because for Parnassa he won?
Oh, yeah. He went for Parnassa, absolutely. The rub started in Warsaw. He also studied the law. That's what he began in the Warsaw Free.
How did he get to America? What year did he come?
What, the rub came 32?
No, the
Rav Aaron. Oh, no, they came in the middle of 1930, a few
did
months.
Did he have a problem with the visa?
No. The family could join Reb Moshe, but she evidently couldn't go out so quickly. They had to finish out the family, the apartment, whatever had to be done in Europe. Goodbyes. They came a number of months later. Exactly when? Maybe Shulamit Meisel mentions
it. It's an indictment on America. How many Jews were probably denied visas?
Indictment of America. We forget about that. Roosevelt. What about England? I mean, one country. Yeah. What about France? The first ones to throw the Jews to the Nazis when they came. It's unbelievable. Look what's going on today with the monuments being turned over. Now there's a whole machloket, what happened in Brooklyn, whether it's anti-Semitism or the earth gave in and the monuments fell. No, I'm serious. It's the questioning it. If you know where the cemetery is, do you know where Washington Cemetery is? It's literally at the edge of Borough Park, at the start of Midwood, which is Flatbush, basically. It's right off the parkway there, Bay Parkway. As a matter of fact, I think it even is adjacent to Bay Parkway as you drive down Bay Parkway. That's two blocks from Ocean Parkway. You follow? You're a little bit east of 13th Avenue, Borough Park. That's what we're talking about. It's a big, big cemetery, mainly non-Jewish. And then there's a big part that is Jewish, with people buried there 100 years ago. It's not from yesterday. If that Kasva Chalila is anti-Semitism, it's beyond words, right in the heart of the Jewish America. But anyway, coming back here, so Rav Aaron, of course, marries in a beautiful family in America. He marries into the Shurin family, Elka Shurin. They tie in with the Rifkin family, and the Rav Aaron's wife, Elka Mashahu, and they have six fabulous children, Rav Aaron and Elka, all who are in Chinuch or the Rabbinate until today. They have four sons and two daughters. Their son-in-law was Rabbi Rafal. Marcus was a Yid Tzadik, a Zeicher Tzadik Lefracha. He was in Toronto. He died young. I recall him very, very fondly. It was something very special. Now, Rav Aaron's sons, so there's one son, Yosef Halevi. Yosef Halevi marries a girl from Toronto. She's also a Soloveitchik. Her grandfather was Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik of Spring Valley. That's a different Soloveitchik.
Why is that they use the same names?
It's the same family. What do you want? It's the same family, don't you?
Everybody writing a biography is going to find Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik.
So that's why I said of Spring. You have to say Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik of Spring Valley. That's why I said Spring Valley. Now, Listen to me carefully. Reb Aaron's son, Reb Yosef, Yosef HaLevi Soloveitchik, marries 1/10 of their blood is the same. Meaning, the Beit HaLevi had 3 wives, the original Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. From the first 2 wives he had children. Yosef and his wife are both from different wives. So it's the same, it's 1/5 of their blood. They come down, 1/10 of their blood is in common. They come down 5 generations, but you have to divide it in half because they're from 2 different wives of the Beit HaLevi. Now, Yosef and his wife, who I happen to know, Tzaddikim Yisodei Olam. If anything, 2 big tzaddikim, I'll put it that way. And I stand in awe of them. They came in Aliyah to the old city. They live in the old city. They live right at the edge of the Jewish quarter. But Reb Yosef, Gaon Adir, of all the sons, he, in my opinion, is the biggest in learning. But he never has mainstream, meaning if I wouldn't talk about him, you wouldn't know about him. And I would love to have seen him a little bit more mainstream, but he has that tzaddik personality that doesn't lend itself to mainstreaming. If you understand what I'm saying, you can visualize. He's a tzaddik yisod olam. He has devoted his life to perpetuating his father's memory, Reb Aaron HaLevi Soloveitchik. To a certain degree, there's a reason why, in my humble opinion, from all 6 children, he's the one that has devoted his life to perpetuating his father's memory. The reason is very simple. Reb Aaron, much later in life, has very difficult circumstances. It's no secret that Reb Aaron leaves Chaim Berlin. He later goes to Yeshiva University. He later leaves Yeshiva University and he goes to Chicago. In Chicago, he has tremendous Achmas Nefesh, tremendous Machloket. Reb Aaron was a Tzaddik Yisod Olam. The word compromise, flexibility with Halacha did not enter into his mindset. In Chicago, you all know the old Mizrahi building they wanted to sell, and they sell it to, I believe it was a Buddhist temple, against his psak. As a result, there's tremendous machlekes, and those that are balabatim that control what you call skoki today, the Hebrew, what's the official word? Hebrew Theological College, Beit Medrash LaTorah in Hebrew. Reb Aaron has to leave, organizes Yeshivat Brisk, goes out on his own, is involved with machlekes with the local Haredim in Chicago. Chicago is owned by the Tells Yeshiva crowd. The Tells branch in Chicago is one of the most successful branches, and a tremendous issue comes up in the Chicago scene. Does anyone know what I'm about to mention? Anybody? The community mikveh, the reform and conservative want to use it for conversion.
What happens if a conservative rabbi... One second.
Don't ask yet. Let me just explain. You're ahead of the class. The reform and conservative want to use it for conversion. The mikveh. Reb Aaron is opposed. Why is he opposed? Because he says, if they tell the world they went to a mikveh that was built by Orthodox Jews, people will think it's a valid conversion. The Tells crowd in Chicago went along with the general feeling the mikveh was built by the community, the money was put in by all types of Jews, they have a right to use the mikveh. No one who will investigate it will say it's an Orthodox conversion, but you can't stop them from using the mikveh. Reb Aaron had a tremendous battle. And in the middle of this battle, with all the Achmas Nefesh particularly from the Haredi world, that the Haredim don't stand with him, he suffered that debilitating stroke. Reb Aaron's years afterwards are a profound in courage, still would travel to New York, couldn't walk, had to be put in the wheelchair, had to be wheeled. Oh, it was such a struggle. I took Reb Aaron to, he wanted to meet the Gerer Rebbe, the Pnei Menachem, and Reb Aaron thought I had the influence, which it turned out I did, to get an appointment with the Pnei Menachem. I had the influence through my students. You just kind of know which telephone to call. And the Pnei Menachem, Reb Aaron, wouldn't go into the wheelchair. We wheeled him out of the cab in the wheelchair. His son, Reb Yosef, of course, was with us. And Rabbi Heschel Reichman was with us, with Reb Aaron, his Talmidim. And he when we approached, I opened up the back entrance to the Gerish Shtibel on the Chov Shiftei Yisrael. Malchei Yisrael, right? Malchei Yisrael, off from Meir Sharima, Malchei Yisrael. Opened up the back approach, so at that point, Reb Aaron got out of the wheelchair, min geht nicht zu sehen the Gerer Rebbe in a wheelchair. You don't go to see the Gerer Rebbe in a wheelchair, and he walked holding on to two canes, and it was just pathetic to watch him every step. When he went to see Jonathan Pollard, do you know that they made him walk? He couldn't take a wheelchair in because they were worried there was dynamite in the wheelchair or something. It's beyond words. Well, you talk about American government and respect for Gedolei Yisrael, respect for religion. So he walked to see the Gerer Rebbe. So the son that suffered the most with this period in Reb Aaron's life was Reb Yosef. Why Reb Yosef? Reb Moshe, the eldest son, who's in Chicago today, he's involved in Hashgacha, a Yireh Tzadik. Reb Eliyahu, who teaches at Landa College, a Rosh Yeshiva at Landa College, they were out of the house. The son who was in the house and was a teenager, unlike his kid brother, Reb Chaim from Beit Shemesh, he understood what was going on. He saw his father suffering. He overheard the phone calls that came in maledicting his father from the right wing, and he named the yeshiva. Don't ask that he named the yeshiva Brisk. It's going to interfere with fundraising for Brisk in Yerushalayim. People will think they gave to Brisk in Chicago, considers Brisk in Yerushalayim the same. And Reb Aaron, they yelled and he yelled and what went on, and a half hour later he hung up the phone. And he had the stroke, lo aleinu. Now, Reb Aaron suffered. Reb Yosef, more than any child, saw his father suffering. And therefore, until today, Reb Yosef Halevi, in my opinion, I'll describe him as caught between two worlds. On one hand, he has Haredi tendencies. He comes from the Soloveitchik family. On the other hand, he has religious Zionist tendencies. He's caught between two worlds. And he just came out with two tremendous volumes on his father. I believe over 1,000 pages, that two volumes. The second volume is totally Chidushei Torah of Chaim, of Reb Aaron, in Hebrew. The first volume, which I'm holding in front of you, a photograph, Yeled Sha'ashu'im. That's Reb Aaron as a little kid on the cover. And around him are pictures. I would imagine this cover was designed by his wife, who's very capable in this area. Around him are pictures of Reb Aaron as he grows older, and the Rav is here, Rabbi Yeprujana is here, all his forebears are here in the pictures. A very, very fascinating volume. Two volumes. The first volume is in English and Hebrew. It needs editing. This is Reb Yosef. Halavai he would have consulted. There's no table of context. There's no index. It is a massive work put together. I would advise you, if you see it for sale, buy it immediately, because like other books that Rav Yosef has put out, they come out on Monday. By Thursday, there is a cheirim against the books in the Haredi world. There are reasons why. Because as I described to you, he's caught between two worlds, but he knows what his father suffered, and he can be very sharp attacking those that criticized his father. Let me tell you a very interesting story, which I know to be true. There's a Sfarim store in Zichron Moshe around the corner from the famous Shtiblach of Zichron Moshe. I think it's called Hagersa, you can tell me.
Yes, right across the street.
Right. So, right after this volume came out, and the word spread already what Rabbi Yosef had published, so a young man, Haredi, with money, comes into the store. Oh, I need a way. I see you're selling Yelet Shashuim. How many sets do you have? So the guy answers 25. And the guy who asks says, I will buy all 25 sets from you right now at whatever price you tell me, but you have to promise me you will never take it in again to the store. To the credit of the person selling, he refused and continued to sell. Now, I'm about to quote, I don't know if I'm going to finish it today. Here you have...
Is it too late for them to get an editor?
Well, you would have to put out a new edition. I haven't... This is over 1,000 pages. It's not a small matter. But you see, he has an introduction. The introduction and the dedication, it overflows into the text. You don't know where the dedication ends and the text begins. Then if you want to find something, there's no index. Now, to be honest with you, this originally came out in what would be the word you would use, in a computer format. It came out on his website, on the computer. It was even larger. I have the original printout in my office. And I quoted, I prepared in certain lectures where I'll reach in the Sunday class. And by the way, you took your question, doesn't hold. I was thinking afterwards, Reb Menashe Klein, 18 volumes, a lifetime of work. Reb Moshe Weiss is just beginning. How do you compare? 100 years from now, Reb Moshe Weiss, the Rakefet's successor, will give a 10,000 shurim on Reb Moshe Weiss. But what a difference. For your edification, very, very important. Nachum Lamb wrote to me that a book is coming out by Yeshiva University about famous volumes, and one of the volumes they're going to analyze is Pachad Yitzchak, being done by a Chaim Berlin graduate named Professor Yaakov Ellman. Recognize the name?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You may study with him in Revel.
See? I studied with him.
Very interesting to see what he writes about the Pachad Yitzchak, how he analyzes it, because you're dealing with someone knowledgeable, insightful, and a Talmud. I mean, I don't know if the Chaim Berlin...
Yeah, it wasn't formally a Talmud, but he had a close relationship.
Yeah. I don't know if Chaim Berlin will acknowledge it, but those are the facts. Anyway, coming back here, this volume, unbelievable what you find there. But in the original manuscript, I have much more. And I have material that he didn't publish here. So you wonder why? It's very simple. In the original manuscript, he actually mentions many names and describes what happened in their lives, and they go to jail afterwards. You know, those who opposed Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, I don't want to go into detail, but can I ask you a simple question? There were tremendous demonstrations going on a few weeks ago against the draft. Highways were closed down, right or wrong, what was going on. Rav Shmuel Orbach, Yomo was practically arrested walking through Shari Chesed. He looked like one of the guys they were looking for, the Yasmanim. You don't know what went on. It's unbelievable. How come it's so quiet now? Do you know or you don't know? Where are you living? It's quiet? Of course it's quiet. Very simple. Elements of the of our greater world are always bringing in money from the world, not declaring it. I don't want to use a bad word, but what they properly called laundering money. Okay? Halbanat kesef. Okay? So the government, they let it go on. They keep track. When they're ready to call you in, they want to teach you a lesson, they act. Knew about 2 weeks ago, the biggest fundraiser for Rav Shmuel Orbach's world, a classic act, unbelievable money, arrived home from a tour around the world with hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. The police picked him up at Ben Gurion Airport. I think he's been in jail ever since. Get the message? Now, in Chicago, all the wealthy Jews are in the senior citizens business. A lot of hanky-panky goes on there, government funding, etc. So he was so furious, names, what happened to them afterwards, going to jail, pressure was put on him. Look, you're mentioning names, you're revealing too much. They have grandchildren today from kids. Let them forget about what their grandfathers were involved with. So the printed edition is more sanitized. It doesn't go into names, not all the details. I have the original, which has a lot more material, for instance, on the bitter fight with the Telz crowd over the mikveh and what went on with the Buddhist temple. Now, this the first, second volume is all in Hebrew, it's the Great Torah. This volume is the way I'm teaching, run on. English, Hebrew, Hebrew. It's Kenken Science, it's the Eichet Abyssal Yiddish. You follow? It's exactly the way I'm teaching. Not the way I would write. When I wrote, if you open up, for instance, the Rav, the World of, every last word is translated. I write the introduction, either if I'm translating from Hebrew, translating from Yiddish, but I'm responsible for the translations, but I guarantee you that this is accurate. There's not one alteration that Rakefet wants to mix his Hashkafer in, God forbid, to the Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. You know what happened to me when the Rav died. It's the first time ever Bar Ilan University turned to me to give a series of lectures at Bar Ilan on the Rav. No, I acquiesce. So after the final lecture, they made a dinner, like a luncheon in my honor to thank me, whatever. And I had given the lecture that day on the Rav's attitude towards synagogue council. And I explained his position. And then at the luncheon, I'm talking privately with some people, and I'm letting off steam against the conservative and the reform, and how I would never sit with them, and how happy I am the synagogue come. So they said, you just gave a lecture. I said, yeah, that was about my Rebbe's opinion. You didn't ask me for my opinion. This is my opinion. You know, I said, I'm not a chassid, I'm a Talmud. There's a big difference. And that's what I told you. I asked the Baron Soloveitchik. I said to Rabbi, remember I told you walking in the old city with Yossi and pushing the wheelchair, and I asked Rabbi, why are we so happy that synagogue council ended? The Rav was in favor. So that was Rabbi's answer, that it's a different reform, a different. And you see this morning how the class began? Look how far we have gone in 100 years. I hope Chovevei Torah people are listening. Okay. Now, how do you know that everything I told you is correct? I mean, Rav Aaron's life is like a movie. I'm just touching upon it very slightly now. All right, let me begin. Page 20. Yeled Sha'ashuim. And this is Yossi Soloveitchik speaking. When Harav Aaron, Rav Yosef Halevi Soloveitchik, let me give him cover. When Harav Aaron was 12 years old, his father went to America to assume the position of Rosh HaYeshiva at Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak in New York City. His parents hired Rabbi Yitzchak Kotner. 10 years, Rav Aaron senior. In other words, Rav Aaron was 12, Rabbi Yitzchak Kotner was approximately 22. To learn with him, Rav Aaron and Rav Kotner would maintain a relationship until the latter's death. Now he quotes Rav Aaron word by word. If this would be edited properly, tell us when your father said it. Tell us whether you're writing it verbatim from a recording, memory, article, we don't know. My educated guess, this is from a recording. Could be when Rav Kotner died. This is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik speaking now, not Rav Yosef, and not yours truly. I was a Talmid of Rav Kotner when Rav Kotner was yet a bacha. When my father left for America, our mishpacha remained for some time in Warsaw. My father asked Rav Kotner to be my Rebbe for that year. My father was makara Rav Kotner because he saw in Rav Kotner a person who through his brilliance could raise a new generation. And my father was mefarsim him. The word mefarsim spelt in English. You follow again. If this was edited, because mefarsim, M-E-F-I-R-A-R, etc. You know, what's he saying here? It's like the transliterations I told you on Rabban. I read modern Hebrew perfectly. You know when I get stuck? When they take an American word. When Rabban Lichtenstein died, I see, oh, what the heck is this? Outsider, who I am, outsider, who old Hishpia. I remember back in 70, 71, I read Hebrew, you know, within a year or two after my arrival, I basic Hebrew when I came, within a year or two, I read Hebrew perfectly. I see in Marav a big headline, Goldaveya mivakeshet miatzolta britain lanu. What the heck is that word? I go to my next door neighbor, Elitzur Devon. I say, Elitzur, what is this word? He says, what, you don't know English? I say, what English? Credit. Tein lanu credit. Credit. Ashrai, credit. Okay? And my father was mefasim him. It was my father who made all the telephone calls to all the directors of Yeshivas, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, Yaakov Yosef. I remember that my father sat and made these phone calls until 1 o'clock in the morning, calling every director. He got a list of the directors of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yaakov Yosef. He called everyone. Point Rav Kotner to Menachel. Rav Kotner did not stay there very long. When he left Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yaakov Yosef, and even before he left, my father got in touch with all the Rabbanim in Brownsville and East New York. He urged them, organize them a tifta. Rav Kotner would become the Menachel and rush Yeshiva in the new tifta. And the story is as follows. At this time, all the Yeshiva had elementary schools. They did not have anything beyond an elementary school. You had Chaim Berlin began elementary yeshiva, founded, by the way, by Mizrachiites in Brooklyn. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, according to Rav Yosef, said Brooklyn needs a post-elementary matifta, a high school with a yeshiva. Organize it. Do like they did in MTA. Why do we... kids from Brooklyn have to travel to Manhattan or stay in the dormitory? There are enough children to go around? Organize it and make Rav Kotner the Rosh Yeshiva. And he began, yes, he begins, giving a shiur for high school freshmen. That's how I began my days as a Malamed Torah for Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchok Hanan. Okay? My father had a very high opinion of Rav Huttner. And he asked Rav Huttner when he left Europe to be my Rebbe. I was just 12 years old. So Rav Huttner learned with me. He started Baba Kama Ba'aba Avot Nezikin, and in less than a year, he learned with me to the end of HaChovel. And then he said we should go over the Rambam, Hilchat Chovel and Mazik. We went over the whole Rambam, Hilchat Chovel and Mazik, as a 12, 13-year-old kid. The impact that Rav Huttner had upon me consisted of much more than just the Gemara Baba Kama. He had a tremendous impact on my whole machshava, again in Hebrew, and especially upon my regashot. He had, and here's the, you will start to understand Rav Huttner, he had the koach of firing the imagination and captivating the imagination of young boys. He had that koach. He had that ability. And here Rav Aaron goes into Divrei Torah, beautiful Divrei Torah, quotes the Gemara in Ma'at Katan, it's twice in Shas, in Ma'at Katan Daf Yud Zayin Amit Aleph, I believe it's also in Chagiga, Im Harav Domer L'malach. Who do you study Torah by? So the Gemara says, quotes the Pasuk of Malachi, Ki Malach Hashem Tzvakhatu. And the Gemara says, if the Rebbe is like a Malach, Lamad Torah Mipiv. You can learn Torah from him. If he's not like a Malach, you can't learn Torah. And the, look at the words, Harav Dome Lamalach Hashem Svakat. And Rav Aaron asked the question, what does it mean? What does it mean? Harav domel malach. Im harav malach Hashem svakat. Learn Torah. Why do you need the word doma if he appears to you to be a malach? If he's a malach, the Rebbe's a malach, he's on the highest level, learn Torah. What does it mean, you conceive? And here Abaran explains Chassidus, and even though he's a misnaked, he apologizes. He says, look, no human being is a malach. An angel is, by definition, on a higher level than a human being. But if in your eyes, you consider, gee, I'm never going to meet a malach, but this Rebbe, this Rav, this Rosh Yeshiva, he's like a malach. This is the way I would imagine a malach to be. He's filled with learning. He's filled with Yirat Shemayim. He's filled with commitment. Im harav doma lamalach, learn Torah from him. And very powerful part. It's not the reality. A rav cannot be a malach. We're only humans. But in your eyes, im harav doma lamalach. And he says, this is the secret of Chassidim. How is Chassidus able to gain such commitment? How is it able to perpetuate itself? How is it able to go from generation to generation? Because in the eyes of the Chassidim, they view their Rebbe like a malach. Doesn't mean he's a malach. There can be many different Rebbeim. But to the Chassidim, this Rebbe, Abelza, Ben Abelza Chassid, Lubavitcher, and here he says, and I have to apologize, I'm a descendant of Mitnagdim, I'm a descendant of Rav Chaim Voloshin, the Talmud Mufak of the Gaon. How am I allowed to speak about this? I said this thought yesterday at the Yud Tet Kislev celebration, evidently in Chicago. He was the guest speaker, Chabad. How am I allowed to speak about this? Because my great-great-grandfather, Reb Chaim Voloshin, decided the machloket between Hasidim and Mitnagdim has to end. And you all know, I've lectured on this extensively. Voloshin Yeshiva, Hasidim came in to study. Reb Chaim never required them to remove their Hasidic garb. Reb Chaim felt there must be shalom between Mitnagdim and Hasidim. Otherwise, he said, Klal Yisrael will be destroyed. And the Hasidim have the right approach. In order to be a Talmud of a Rebbe, the Rebbe has to captivate and fire the imagination of the Talmud. And if he doesn't fire the imagination of the Talmud, he cannot be his Talmud. Chazal say, Im harav domeh lemar Hashem tzvakod. Chazal do not say, Im harav hu kamalach Hashem tzvakod. Chazal say, domeh. As long as the Talmud imagines that his Rebbe is a malach, then he can be his Talmud. But if a Talmud in his heart is critical of a Rebbe, should not be his Talmud. Because, and listen to Rav Aaron's words, because then it is a parasitic relationship. You're just taking from the Rebbe his knowledge, what he can give you, but you're like a parasite. You don't reward the Rebbe that you feel he's his Talmud. If someone is critical of a Rebbe and he still learns Torah from him because he finds it to his advantage, then it is a parasitic relationship with the Rebbe. Im harav domeh lemalach Hashem tzvakot, Chassidim have the right approach. Satma Chassidim consider the Satma Rebbe as a malach. Bels Chassidim do not consider the Satma Rebbe as a malach, but they consider the Bels Rebbe as one. The Ger Chassidim consider the Ger Rebbe as a malach. I am not criticizing the Chassidim. I am praising the Chassidim. They have the right approach. When the Rebbe is a Malach, then you can be a Chassid. Then you can be a Talmud. Because the Satmar Rebbe in their imagination is a Malach, they can be his Chassidim. Whether they are right or wrong is not important. Assuming they are not right. So what? The Satmar Rav is able to fire their imagination. They consider him a malach. And then he got very powerful, interesting. And Rav Hutna was one Mignagdisha Rosh Yeshiva who is like a Hasidisha Rebbe. The other Hasidisha Rebbeim have a dynasty, so they inherited. Rav Hutna was able to become a Hasidisha Rebbe and to fire the imagination of hundreds of Talmidim. He came a Hasidic Rebbe, not through Yerusha, but through scholarship and through brilliance. Very powerful words. This is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik talking about Rav Hutna. Very powerful. We'll continue.
That applies to us in the role.
Absolutely.
When you sat in the Rosh Shia,
right.
You actually felt, I'm not trying to be
Matan Torah.
As if you were at Sinai.
Right.
You heard the insights that stayed with you for life.
Matan Torah. We have a lot more to do, but I have more to do later.
But so he had a Hasidic hearts.
Right. It's unbelievable. And you got to remember, this is Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, who later leaves Chaim Berlin, and you know the whole split with the Rav. But look at the Hakarat HaTov. We owe Reb Yosef a great thank you, because this you'll see. I have a lot more, but this is first person speaking. This is Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. This is Rav Hutna. You'll see more.
Well, but this is also an insight in a way to sum up. Your lectures on the
Balaji
Rebbe.
I'm going to say this. Believe me, we gained a lot from our lectures on the Rebbe. But let me say, what did we do? First of all, I want to be Moida LaKadosh Baruch Hu that I'm here in health and happiness. And a week ago today, it was frightening. But it was only, I had a virulent infection. I left a note on the board and I ran from here to the doctor and I was a walk-in and only one person was ahead of me. So I had a very thorough examination. Baruch Hashem, a mensch bleibt a mensch. And we grow older, we have to know our constraints. I can't run around like I did 20, 30, 40 years ago. You know, I turned down all offers to speak here. I said, if you want to hear me, come to the Kollel. So no one knows where the Kollel is. So we wind up Baruch Hashem. You know what Baron Lichtenstein said the first time he was in this building? I took him in, I'm showing him around. I mean, I did have a schut. I got this building for Yiddishkeit. And so Baron said, Hamakom nifla hamikum asam. And he was so right. Then it was worse than now. But today there's a bus once an hour. Okay, so what did we do today? I'd love to see a biography of Rav Huttner. You'll see they don't mention a word about the correspondence to Levi Ginsberg and Pachat Yitzchak. But it would be very interesting to see one day a critical biography and how they deal with this.
They never told us. Did he ever meet with him?
We don't know. We only have the letter. We don't know what happened. We only have the letter because Mark Shapiro evidently discovered it in Louis Ginsberg's archives. He received the letter, and Mark probably explored the archives at the JTS.
So that means that at that time, they were not yet considered a deviant organization?
They were Choshesh already by the 1930s, but it's not like today or what I read to you this morning. You follow? That's the end already. And we hit upon Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. We started next week there's no Shir, obviously. Sunday, Monday is Purim. Well, we pick up the week afterwards. My dear students, I want to show you, if you want to come close, I want to flip some of the pages. Come around. This, I can't get over it. This just came out, the early years of the Rebbe, 1902 to 1929. What's amazing, the documents that have survived, I mean, you're talking about after Hitler, after the communists, they go back, they photograph all the places that you can photograph today. It's, I can't get over, this is the Yitzchak, do you recognize this? No?
Was that in Italy?
What Italy? That's the synagogue in Moscow.
Oh, Akhapova.
Yeah, that's Akhapova. Look at the letters that survive. And here's the rocket shover. He corresponded with his letters, the passports. Take a look at the, and it's a beautiful, beautiful volume. I mean, it's on many levels, the documents, and before you reach the documents, they give you all the information. You see, that relates to the documents and first person interviews that survive from articles of it's unbelievable what they were able to put together. So I have to, and maps of every place the 6th and 7th Rebbe lived, marked off what homes, what was where. It's wow. What a piece of work.
Where did you get the volume? Or they sent it to you?
They sent it to me, yeah. But they sent it to me before publication, and I wrote my feelings on it, so they'll probably use it in publicizing. Anyway, I have to say, what I thought about, Yitzchak will appreciate this, could we do this to the Rav? And you know what the answer is? No. Why? Because Chabad, there's that feeling of adoration to the Rebbe. People saved every scrap of paper. The Rav, they had a they had some letters from the Rav. They sold them off at auction here at the Plaza Hotel many years ago. And I'm ashamed to tell you a few hundred dollars came in, you understand. Jay Solomon bought the invitation to the Rav's wedding. And I'm always makir tova to Jay. The first thing he did with the invitation, he gave it to me. He gave me the original, said, photograph it, do what you want. I wanted to use it in the Rav, but Tova said it's too personal. So, all right, it'll be published 100 years from now.
That's such an odd thing in my sense, too.
What do you mean, such an odd thing?
The wedding invitation is private? It's invitation.
It's too personal. But here, you see, Chassidim, what they served, the research, what went into this volume. Now, they do charts, I mean, and then they thank all the people that helped. The list is practically endless. You see all the names here. But let me tell you, what Chabad can do, no one else can do. Plain and simple. I just feel bad, the Messianist. It hurt me yesterday. I told you in class, I'm walking here and I see the car. It says, Happy Hanukkah. And underneath, Yechid Adonai Moreinu Rabbeinu Melech Mashiach L'Olam V'Ed. All right, but we got to put up. What can we do? Yitzchak, this is for you. You'll see he's a Gaon Adir. This is Usher Weiss taking the topic of curtains around the temple. Are they allowed to blow in the breeze? And then he analyzes it with a Reuven, with Sukkah. You can't believe what a Gaon we're dealing with. Here are tapes, DVDs, I should say. Two of the same. This is all anti-Arab propaganda. If anyone wants, welcome to it.
I call it Hasbara.
Hasbara. Okay. Here, two of these. This is the Satmar Ruv in Palm Springs putting tefillin on with the Chabadnikim.
Oh, wow. Well, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, interesting. Whoever wants. This is the story. I think it's Rabarul. Am I right?
One of them, I think, has a good relationship with Rabarul. This one, I imagine.
This is the story of stopping a meeting to daven mincha and the impact it has on the professor. This famous story, Professor Green. Here, only Chabad, only a chassid can understand this. A picture surfaces now of the Rebbe walking to his house when he first moved to... He wasn't Rebbe yet. He was the son-in-law. See, now, Litvak looks at this. What's the big deal? You don't even see the person. A chassid looks at it. Wow. That's beautiful, beautiful. This is Halacha L'maisa. Chabad Shluchim in Hebron are now leaving. A new Shluchim are coming in. And the army makes a party for them, a farewell for them. Take a look at this. I look to see if any of my grandchildren are here, but that's not my grandchildren's unit. But what a beautiful, God bless them. Rabbi Bezal Kim, his relationship to the Rebbe. This is an interesting story. Lubavitch gets the last laugh involving Israel today. This... also relationship to the Rebbe, what he learned from the Rebbe. These are endless pictures. Chabad just had a teenage conference, 1,500 Chabadnikim, kids, Motzai Shabbos in Times Square with Havdalah on the big screen up in the air that they have there. What do you see? All the pictures. It's right, you makarov, you wake them up to Yiddishkeit. Spiritual guests, again, the Rebbe. Now, a Chabadnik died known as Schwartzy. And character par excellence.
California.
This is all about Schwartzy and what he did in his life. Rabbi Shlomo Schwartz, a shaliach there. And this, they have a whole display of the Rebbe at Fabrenian's. We were once young. Here's, take a look, that's Label Groner with a black beard. The Rebbe already is basically white, gray. If anyone, the trouble is they don't identify for everyone. This is very interesting. At the Chabad and Zayda's funeral, the descendants sang a niggun. But this was their Zayda's favorite niggun. Very moving story. And here about a magza that a Jew threw away after the Holocaust and married a Goya, never wanted anyone to know he was Jewish. And they found the matzah, the matzah turns up, and Chabad in London, I believe it is, turned it into a whole celebration that the matzah survives, and they're using it. Beautiful little story. Ah, what a beautiful world we have. Chalavad, we shouldn't harm it. Thank you so much for being my students. I want to say thanking to all those listening, and once again, I thank you for the emails that came in of health. Sherry is not going to be in a few days. Her daughter is being operated as we speak, an appendicitis operation. So I'm going to have a problem with emails. But
I have your copies of Cardoza's thing that I don't want, because I haven't read it.
Oh, can I see it then?
Yeah, please take it. I brought it in for the give out for the guys.
This is the new essay where he criticizes the rabbi?
No, there's three the same.
Yeah, they're three the same. If anyone wants, no, it's worth reading to see what we're up against. Until we meet again in health and happiness, a Freilich and Purim, a Freilich and Shushan Purim. Think about going to Tel Aviv Sunday, come to Yerushalayim Monday. Do you have to read Megillah with a bracha both days? Interesting question.
And the answer?
Think about the other one, going to Yerushalayim Sunday, Tel Aviv Monday, and abolishing Purim altogether. You want a quick answer? It's no quick answers. To abolish Purim altogether, you're Mamisha Russia. But right. A guy can do it. There was a professor in
Hebrew. No, they say it was. I asked his son, he told me no.
It's not so. They said about him that he did it. He couldn't take Jews killing Goyim. Both days with a bracha, I would paskin not a bracha the second day. It doesn't make sense. But you would have a chiyuv to hear the Megillah. It's not so simple. You would have to go hear it. I have grandchildren who had Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim. You know, they went ahead to the yeshiva, then they came back to Yerushalayim. So I told them the second day you have to hear and do everything, but don't make a bracha. Others told you make a bracha. I mean, it's a homach like it, but to my mind, it doesn't make sense to say you make a bracha. Tuning it again in health and happiness, das vidanya. Okay.